Well, who's gonna do the intro? I don't even know how.
No,
Steve's not here.
Steve back.
Where's Steve? Let's see if we can do it from memory. You got to help me out.
Okay.
Hi, you. That's good that you've reached the carnivore theology something. And
listen in and have fun.
Yeah. And something about world changing followers of Jesus Christ. Yeah. CarnivoreTheology.com, speakpipe.com/CarnivoreTheology, Facebook.com/CarnivoreTheology, iTunes.
Don't know how that one works.
So our topic today is, what are you reading? Steve's gone, so we're going to do, what are you reading? And we are also going to do a SpeakPipe question. And then we're going to do a quick little book promo, so that'll be fun. All right. Are you ready to go?
I am.
Oh, man, I can't believe we got kicked out of that restaurant. That is the second one in a week. That is just dumb.
Well, Al, I think that it has to do with your extremely loud prayers about heterosexual marriage.
It could be. That could be part of it. You know what's annoying? And this happens all the time. As soon as you sit down to say grace as a pastor, all of a sudden, you know, half the crowd within earshot is converted. And people are just sick of having all these converted Christians in there. Just boom, they don't know what to do. They have to baptize people in the back room. It's just a frustrating thing for them. So we get kicked out.
It does get very awkward.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you convert people in a restaurant and baptize them in the back room. I'm wondering if they ever show up at church or if that's kind of the last you ever see of them.
I'm just there for lunch. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, I think the Holy Spirit is so present in grace and in the prayers that it shows up. I mean, that's obviously the fear, and we'll talk about it next week maybe, but that's the fear of why they're kicking all prayer out of all the civic meetings and things like that around different cities. You know, obviously it's because if anybody were to say an opening prayers, then all of a sudden they would be forced to convert to Christianity, and everybody knows what happens after you do that.
Yeah, I think that's in coming up in an upcoming episode, but that is a major issue, and it's sad for Canadians.
And so we got kicked out, and anyway, now we're driving along the road, and I figured it'd be a good time for us to ask the question. So, Chad, what are you reading?
What am I reading? Well, being extremely pious, Al, I do have to say that currently I am reading the Bible. And this is actually a bestseller. It's quite a good book. It has some highly, highly interesting and effective things in it. Good stuff every time you read it.
Yeah, anything I follow up with that is going to be obviously inferior. Thanks so much. You just pulled out the big guns right at the beginning.
That's why I did it. I
finished the conversation.
Sure, yeah.
Next, I'm not letting you go first ever again. Now you're supposed to ask me what I'm reading.
Yeah, right, Al. You know, what semi-pious thing are you reading?
Well, actually, it's not pious at all. My first thing on my list, I went through a bunch of emotionally weird stuff and was experiencing a bunch of tough stuff in church and in my own life and reading a bunch of tough stuff around Easter. So I got kind of mentally and emotionally tired.
She went for Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, well, no, that's a staple. So I wanted to read something kind of fictiony, which is not something I do very often, but not useless. So I actually read through C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy.
Oh, how was it?
It's a philosophical, science fiction, allegorical-ish, although at the beginning he says it's not an allegory, commentary on society, religion, morality, and how to think. Huh. The series is good from beginning to end. It's very long, but it's very good. It gets kind of preachy at times. Reminds me of things like The Matrix or Inception or Blade Runner, which actually it's really interesting to experience, but you know that there's some deep and meaningful subtext down there that kind of makes you think. So just as a summary, book one is a book called Out of the Silent Planet, which is about a man named Ransom who gets kidnapped and he gets taken to a very old and dying planet of Mars.
Wait, his name is Ransom.
Ransom. Like, yeah, right, yeah.
Good, good.
And he gets kidnapped. He goes to Mars, where he meets a group of beings, and each group that he meets is very different from the next, but they understand how to get along with each other. And then some bad guys show up, the ones who kidnapped him. They show up, and they're trying to exploit the planet, take all the gold out of it and stuff, and they start messing with that system, and they're all judged by the guardian angel of the planet, and that sets up the rest of the series, which moves us into book two. A book called Prelandra, which is definitely my favorite book of the three. It's beautiful. It's unique. Ransom is sent by the guardian angel of Mars to go help out Venus, which is actually a brand new planet, and it only has two people on it.
Well, naturally.
Basically, Adam and Eve. Although Adam we learn, has taken off. So the bad guy from the first book, he shows up and he tries to get Eve to sin for the first time, and Ransom is there to try to stop it. It's super creative, but being C.S. Lewis, it's also really smart, and it makes you think about temptation. So it was written a year after the Screwtape Letters, so there's a ton of echoes of the Screwtape Letters happening all throughout the book.
I was going to say, this enemy who tries to convince the new Eve to sin sounds like it might be a familiar trope.
Yeah, it is, and it really is. It's really interesting, and I don't want to give it away. If I give away any more, it'll
yeah, don't tell. Book.
If you like the Screwtape Letters, you will like Prelandra.
I've been meaning to read those. I just haven't ever got around to it.
They're really good. They're really, really good. Hideous Strength is the third book. It's the most science fiction-y of the books. It really gets into that evil organization tries to take over the world feel to it. It's also very spiritual. It asks the question, what if God existed in science fiction? It's definitely the most graphic of any C.S. Lewis book that I've ever read. Really disturbing parts in it, some really gross stuff, some sexual stuff, but it's super interesting. One of the most interesting parts is this husband-wife narrative that happens kind of alongside the story, and that's all I can say. It does get somewhat long. C.S. Lewis starts kind of giving lectures logic and morality through his characters that last for pages and pages and pages and pages. It's interesting, but you end up kind of flip. That's what I read. It was great, and I recommend it to everyone. If you don't want to read all three, definitely read number two, especially if you like Screwtape Letters.
Mm.
What are you reading?
Well, I've got an English book. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm also reading the ESV, the NIV, the TNIV, and it's really blowing my mind.
I like to go for a little bit different things and just try to broaden out my understanding. And I've recently got a book actually from the local public library. It's called Understanding Ancient Civilization Series. And this one's The Ancient Greeks, A New Perspective. And what's new about it is that it's attempting to look at the human condition, as it were, in and through and under the great events of Greek history. We're quite familiar with the majority of big picture Greek history and the mythologies of Greece, but it's asking what it looked like to live under that. Frankly, it's just fascinating. It's interesting because humans are really the same in any given time. And, you know, to see the way people react to certain things, you know, talking about the Spartans, just as a brief example, the Spartans were a people who sort of divided up their culture into a warrior class of Spartan citizens who spent all of their time training for war and doing nothing else.
I've seen the documentary 300.
Right. And then they had a class of, I just lost the term that they called them, Greeky guys that did work for them, laboring in the fields. They were slaves, essentially. And then they had a class of artisans. And the artisans were not citizens and not slaves. They were free to move in and out, but they're very important to the culture. But in the warrior class, when you were a child, you were raised by your mother until you're about the age of six. And then you were moved into a barracks where you lived with other boys. And teenagers and into like kind of 25, 30 years old were the people who trained the younger boys. The older boys were mentoring and training the younger boys. And just to read about the brutalities was interesting because, you know, if we got a bunch of 10-year-old kids and a bunch of 14-year-old kids supervising them, all boys, and left them without adult supervision, we can imagine that things would get exciting.
That's a different book. That's called Lord of the Flies.
Yeah. As the children grow up, they in that earliest age, they are, for example, not given enough food. They're given enough to keep them alive and, I guess you would say, healthy, but not enough to fill them up, especially as growing boys. And so the boys sneak out and try to steal food from either the kitchens or from the community around them. And there is an expectation that they would do so. In fact, part of the training is in the hopes that they would learn to forage for food in a sneaky way. However, if they get caught, they're severely punished. So they're trained all the way along not to be caught, but it's set up so that they will steal, but punished if they get caught stealing. So theft isn't wrong, getting caught is. And so as these kids become mature soldiers and they go out in the field, if they're ever trapped behind enemy lines, they're going to know exactly what to do. This is all part of the thing. And it's just interesting. But it's interesting because they present the moral conundrums and the way that the different people react to that. The human condition appears to be universal. So it's just a fascinating study.
That's interesting. Wonderful.
Yeah, what else for you?
To continue along my progression of things I like that are philosophical thinking, the next one I did was, while I was reading C.S. Lewis' Space Trilogy, I was also reading 1984 and Animal Farm.
Yes.
Because it seemed that every other podcast or news article or blog or tech blog I was reading came across the words Orwellian dystopia or just like in 1984. Specifically, what kicked it off was a TV by Samsung they invented, which had a camera and a microphone on the front. And right. The idea was it was kind of going to be like Siri, where you'd be able to say to your TV, turn on, turn the channel on or do whatever. And it would have a constant stream via internet that would go to some house somewhere where a computer was running that would analyze what you said. And it would make your TV do that. It sounds like a great idea. In the manual, it said that the microphone does not turn off. Don't worry. We're not recording you. Nobody will ever see this, blah, blah, blah. And they kind of put this right next to the TVs in 1984 that are always on. You can't turn them off. They're always listening to you, you know, kind of thing. And so I'm like, I got to read 1984.
Don't worry. They're not listening to you.
I'm really glad I read it, although it depressed me so much for a solid week. And then I read Animal Farm, and that made me even more depressed. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, basically it's a book about what would happen if an evil government were to use technology to oppress humanity. Individualism and non-approved thinking becomes prohibited. Surveillance is omnipresent. You can't get away from it. History is forgotten or rewritten if it disagrees with what the government says. Everyone is drugged. They have drugs in everything. And love for anything other than the government actually turns out to be illegal. The parallels to stuff that's going on today is pretty wild. I mean, this is the book we get terms like Big Brother is watching you, or the thought police, or double think. That's what that's from. There's tons of stuff in this book. It kind of makes a person afraid of the future that we see coming, and you kind of want to smash every electronic device in your entire house.
Don't worry, they're not listening.
Oh, man. And honestly, it's like, I never, ever want to go anywhere, and everybody's looking at me, and I'm freaking out, and everyone's evil, and you just kind of see it. An amazing, amazing series of stories in there.
Have you ever noticed how the O in Google looks kind of like the ring from the Lord of the Rings, like Sauron's ring?
Or an eye that's always looking at you.
It's the all-seeing ring of Sauron, Google.
All right, Chad, what's next?
Yeah, we were trying to discuss how to describe this. You know, we want to move from milk to meat, but this might be moving from milk to a filet mignon. But this actually is a valuable book, and I would recommend it to any pastor. Particularly any Bible college student, but you would have to have some background knowledge of the concepts of hermeneutics or the art and science of interpreting texts, or really, as this book particularly argues, the philosophy behind our art and science of interpreting text. It's called New Horizons in Hermeneutics, The Theory and Practice of Transforming Biblical Texts by Anthony Thistleton.
That's a good, solid name. I just trust him immediately.
Yes, and of course, he's a professor at the University of Nottingham.
No surprise there.
And emeritus canon theologian at Leicester Cathedral.
I'm picturing him traipsing through Sherwood Forest right now.
Isn't that amazing? The University of Nottingham, which is particularly fun. This is the Robin Hood of hermeneutics. And in many ways, I'm not actually kidding. Generally speaking, he works within secular world in the University of Nottingham, but he's a Christian, an evangelical Christian. And he essentially rescued the very idea of reading text from postmodernity almost single-handedly.
What does that mean?
Well, basically, rationalism grew out of the Enlightenment, which said that by reason we can perceive all things and learn all things and know all things. And part of that was going back to the sources, to original text, to Greek and Roman writers, including the Bible and its Greek and Hebrew. And by working through that, we're going to come to these great new insights and come to truth. This became a discouraging pursuit when people continued to argue over what was the truth. And so the experiment of modernity began to break apart. What some have called postmodernity, which is also a movement now which seems to have died or is dying in the academic world, came to see that you cannot actually find truth and began to argue that was because there is no meaning in language, no meaning in text that can be discerned. Everything is subjective. Everything is culturally driven. And so you had deconstructionism, which read Shakespeare and the Bible in the same way as essentially nonsense that could be recreated the way you wanted it. Jacques Derrida, in fact, had a phrase where he said, I like to play with texts. I'm playing with them and making them say whatever I want them to say. Now, you will have experienced that when you've heard someone say, you can make the Bible say whatever you want it to say. Mm-hmm. Now, what he has done is basically argued that when we come to this, to texts in general, that texts can actively shape and transform the perceptions, understandings, and actions of readers and reading communities. Legal texts, medical texts, and biblical texts provide examples, but texts can also suffer transformation at the hands of readers and reading communities. Hmm. And so what he's argued is we need to have two horizons in mind whenever we read a text. We need to have the horizon of our experience, our community, our interests in mind, and we need to have the horizon of the original author and the original readership in mind. And where those two horizons come together, they interpret one another. That is, that the way the original author saw things will begin to shape the way we view our world, and the way we view our world is actively shaping that text. So we can either be transformed by the text, or we can transform the text. Hmm. Hence, it's a double play on words, the theory and practice of transforming Bible reading. And the warning to us is, yeah, you can make the Bible say whatever you want it to say, or the Bible can speak to you in a way that makes you say what it wants you to say. Right. And it's that awareness that we have in order to do it. And of course, he does it, and that I simplified it pretty grossly, but yep. Definitely worth reading. It is going to hit you up with all kinds of, you know, guys from the history of the interpretation of text. He interacts with linguistics and secular literature, as well as biblical thought. It weighs in at just 800 pages or so. Anyway, it's a read, but well worth it. Any pastor, any Bible college student, or an interested Christian who maybe has a little bit of background in English literature, or someplace where they may have been exposed to some of the stuff. He's a great reader. He's English. He writes like a funny, humorous English reader. Nice. And sometimes you'll be laughing your head off, even if you don't know who Foucault is, you know.
Excellent.
Well, how about you, Al? You got something else?
The last one I'm reading, just so you know that I don't spend all my time reading philosophical fiction, is a book called Two Views on Women in Ministry. Counterpoints, Bible and Theology. So I'm in a phase right now where I'm kind of challenging some of the things that I've already settled in my mind, and I want to unsettle them. I'm kind of kicking back up some mental dust so I can think about what I really know and to things I already feel that I understand, but I want to take another look at. So I'm only about a quarter of the way through this, and I've read the egalitarian view of women in ministry and leadership and eldership. And I've got some really interesting challenges from it. I'm still looking forward to reading the counterpoints in a couple more sections to get the full story. But I think it's important that we challenge ourselves every now and again. And that's
what you're doing is taking that author's horizon and your current views and placing them together with full knowledge that you're doing that and seeing how they transform one another.
Yep. That's exactly what I'm doing. And it's been an interesting challenge. In fact, it kind of spawned from the fact that I'm looking for other positions right now for work, for ministry. And I have gotten through various interviews, and a couple times I've gotten through multiple interviews to the point where it seemed like they were ready to hire me. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of offhandedly said, oh, by the way, what's your position on women in ministry?
And you offhandedly answered it.
And I said, well, I'm a complementarian. And they went, oh, well, that's wonderful. Have a nice life. Click. So it became an interesting pursuit of positions and all the right. So now I have to really know what I'm thinking in this realm.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. It's question time.
Hi, Steve, Pastor Chad, and Pastor Alan. I'm enjoying listening to your podcast, and I've really been trying to grow in my life, especially spiritually. I have a question on church behavior. Should we wear ball caps Sunday morning to church in the sanctuary as we worship God? And should we bring our coffee along for the service? Thank you for your time, and keep up the good work. Blessings on you, gentlemen. This is Jarvis from Saskatchewan.
That's Jarvis from Saskatchewan. That is an excellent question. And is that not extremely relevant to today? And just before we answer his question, this is just a frankly curious, Al. Do you see people coming into your church typically with ball caps and coffee cups in their hands?
Coffee cups occasionally, and I'll be one of them. Ball caps. We have one young lady who showed up with a ball cap every single week. There was one dude who came with a ball cap, but generally, no. I got a fairly conservative church right now.
Yeah.
And they would be looking at that. They would probably get a little bit of a sideways glance if they did.
I'm just curious because our setting is very different because we're in a kind of a church plant stage and we meet in a community center and there's much more of a casual feel to it. And I find when I'm in a traditional church setting, I tend to see less of that. And in a setting like ours, I just tend to see more of that. I think it's a bit of a feel. So I was just curious. Okay, so go ahead. Why don't you fire off if you have some thoughts on that question?
Let's take it apart because there is kind of two sections. And so let's say this. We covered the hat side of this already in a previous episode that we called What Clothes Should a Pastor Wear? And it basically came down to three things. First, beware of your context. because certain things are going to cause problem for certain people and it won't for others. Number two was be aware of your motives when you dress yourself. What's your motive for putting that hat on? You know, is it are you trying to show off or is it just part of your life? I don't know. What's your motive? And the third is we should bear with one another and be careful not to judge each other superficially. So if the guy comes in and he's wearing a ball cap, it's not on us to judge him. So let's kind of put that one aside. But the coffee question is a good one. There's no verse that prohibits drinking coffee in church. Food is an important part of worship, and it's an important part of gathering as Christians. We know that from places like Acts 2. But I think we go back to what we talked about in the close. The question is, for your church, in your context, what does your church culture say about that coffee cup? Is it general practice, like at Chad's church? Is it not a big deal to most people? Is it approved of, even encouraged by the elders to create a familiar atmosphere? Or, in your context, is bringing the coffee an exception, only done by a few people, the rebels, and generally discouraged, you know? Even though it's sort of permitted, nobody says you can't do it, but it's kind of discouraged. So that's my first question. What does your church culture say? Second question is, what's your motive? Are you bringing coffee because, you know, we have coffee when we gather together? That's a Canadian thing to do. Everybody shows up with their Tim's cup and nobody even thinks about it. Or are you addicted?
We have Team Tim's and Team Starbucks.
Yeah, I bet. Exactly. So, but that's part of Canadian culture and people don't even think about it.
We'll have to get shirts like those Twilight ones.
Maybe if you show up and it's part of an addiction, that's a problem. As in, you can't deal with life without coffee. You got to think about that. And so my third question is it a distraction? We're to greet people. We're to raise our hands in worship. We're to sing to the Lord. We're to pay attention during the sermon. So does your coffee make that easier? Or does it distract you from engaging in worship, prevent you from concentrating on anything because you spend half your time in the bathroom rather than in the service? So that's my three questions. What does your church culture say? What's your motive behind bringing it? And is it a distraction? What do you think, Chad? Yeah.
I'm just going to back it up kind of a step from there. So he asked at the beginning, it's a question about church behavior, and then illustrated it, I think, with the issue of the ball caps and coffee.
Yep.
Just for a historian's perspective, the issue of the ball caps, without getting into it too much, that comes from 1 Corinthians 11. Many people know that because it says women should wear head coverings, but it also commands that men must not wear head coverings. And so in Western culture, there is a tradition of respect where we doff our hat for the singing of the national anthem. That's a symbol of respect and so on like that. So that's still actually a little bit of a part of our culture. And so I would be very wary when we deal with those cultural issues to actually make sure you understand it, because especially young people who simply don't, they often cause unwarranted offense. And as believers, we don't want to do that. Right. But we still need to understand where it comes from. That's a little historian side note. It goes back to church behavior. And actually, this is a struggle that I have personally in thinking through. And it's interesting for me because in my context, I said, we sort of have an intentionally warm and relaxed environment, and we kind of like that. It's a bit of a family environment, and there's a sense where the church is the family of God. But you have many scriptural passages in both Old and New Testament that tell us we should have a bit of a different feel as well. And I'm just going to read one from Hebrews chapter 12, which references Mount Sinai, where God came down to the top of the mountain, and there was flaming fire and thunder and lightning, and the people were terrified and thought they were going to die and said, please don't let God speak to us anymore. Let Moses go up, and he can come back and talk to us. Whatever he says, we'll do. I love that. That's typically the way people feel about their pastor, I think, right, Al? This looks like it could be life-threatening. Al, you go in there and figure it out. And
let us know how that goes.
So Hebrews 12 is referring to that and comparing that. And it says, we have not come to Mount Sinai, to that place in verses 18, 19, 20, where it says they couldn't endure there. It says, but, verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to the innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly, that's the church, of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, a mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better than the word of the blood of Abel. I just bring that one up. There are other passages. Yeah. So think about that. That's when we come to church, we're participating in the church universal. And I want you to imagine yourself standing now in the midst of the heavenly throne room. God is sitting on his throne. The Lord Jesus in all his majesty and glory, the shining brilliance that Peter and them saw on the Mount of Transfiguration. The angels in their festal gatherings are standing essentially in court okay? And there you are, and you've been holding a cup of coffee. Let's say the rapture happened, right? You know, you're holding your cup of coffee in your hand. Do you drop that cup of coffee and stand in awe? Or are you going to sit there and go, ah, this is good stuff. Ah, yo, Jesus, what up, dog?
You know what? Okay, I'm going to counterpoint you because I'm going to take this back to Acts. Yeah. And we're going to talk about the original church. We're going to talk about how people getting together and they're eating food together and they're enjoying one another. They're in house churches.
Yes.
You know, Corinthians, which talks about gathering together during your feasts and meals and the actual culture of being able to hang out with one another, to be real with one another, to before work and after work and being together as a family. And that all has to do with food and that all has to do with coffee. I don't think we get the to pull the, would you do that when the, you know, well, would you wear your hat in front of the queen?
No, remember, you know. Aldo, remember the context I put that in is these are counterbalancing scriptures to those scriptures. I already said there's a sense of the family of God sense in scripture, but I think we have to take a bigger picture. And the conclusion of this whole chapter is this: since we're there, let's be grateful for it, it says, and let us offer up to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is consuming fire. And that's the concern that I have, is not with the coffee as such. It's with the attitudes with which we worship.
Exactly.
And going back to church behavior, and we've already made that point in general, I'm thinking we need to keep both in tension. Because, as Al said, part of worship is eating. But you know what? That's at the part of worship that is eating. I bet you if you went to the early church and you came to their love feast and you were eating with them, you'd enjoy it a whole lot. But I'll bet you when James was praying, there weren't people munching Doritos.
Okay, now, but let me say this. You've got different levels of maturity in your church. And so new believer, new guy shows up. He is straight off the tractor, or he is, you know, straight up the street or whatever. Yeah. He comes in. He doesn't know how to be a churchy guy. He just, you met him for coffee. He wanted to meet your church, and he wants to know Jesus. Yeah. He shows up wearing a ball cap. He sits down.
Yeah.
If you turn around to him and say, here's our list of rules on how to show up in our church, how dare you? Don't you know, you know, not only you're going to lose him, you're going to offend him. And I don't think God's happy with that.
No.
On his realm of maturity, you know, as he grows in Christ, as he reads his scriptures, you know, that's when that reverence starts to take hold of his heart. That's when things are going to start to change. So I think we got to be careful jumping in too quick.
So, but it's because it's that matter of reverence to me, the way I would think of it, and to answer Jarvis from Saskatchewan's direct question is, if I'm a maturing believer, when I come to church, I want to do what's contextually appropriate. In my church, we frequently have coffee, snack, and even potluck after our services. And we all feast like crazy. Before the service, we're doing setup and we're visiting and chatting. And we all, I think, I bet you can't find an exception. Everybody has either their Timmy's or their Starbucks or their home brew in their mug. And we're just enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And as the service starts, there's a bit of a transition. Personally, I put my coffee away. I worship in the service. And then, you know, after I give the benediction, I walk to the back to greet people. And on my way to the back, I walk by our coffee table, which is in our worship area. And I fill up with that coffee and I take it and I stand there and I sip on my coffee and I greet visitors and I enjoy it. And so to me, it's a matter of propriety to what's actually going on. And I think there is a sense we ought to have enough reverence that we're not munching and slopping while we're listening to the word of God in prayer. It's kind of weird.
You're not in a movie theater. Yeah. You're not in a restaurant. You are not in your living room. You are at church. So that needs to be taken into account.
But at the same time, being a judgmental weirdo, like you all pointed out, I think that's critical. Way too many times you have a judgmental spirit. And
oh yeah,
I'm being reverent, but a new believer coming in, what they need to see is us being reverent. So anyway, hope that answers your question. But we're really glad you're listening, and we deeply thank you for your question. And we hope that we continue to get more good speak pipe questions like that. That really moves the conversation forward.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks so much, Jarvis. This is the part where you said you wanted me to do my book promo.
Oh, yes. I knew that. We've been talking about books all day. And whether we're talking about the greats of church history like St. Irenaeus, the second century brilliant biblical theologian, whether we're talking about modern theologians like Anthony Thistleton, we are continuing to having input going into the church. And I think the next great author who is going to be beyond that of St. Irenaeus and beyond that of Dr. Anthony Thistleton, whosoever from Nottingham University, is our own, the great Ellen DeGeno, VDM.
Thank you.
Elle has actually written, though, an interesting book. I did read a pre-publication copy of it and was involved in editing it, so all editation errors are my fault.
All errors, period.
Tell us a little bit about the book, Elle.
All right. Well, I've been working on this book for a little while now. It's supposed to be out 3 Christmases ago, but for various reasons, it was postponed. But it's
the editor. I blame the editor.
It's almost ready. This book actually came from an encounter that I had with God after reading Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 to 4, where it says this: "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be done in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you." As I was reading that, God kind of gave me new eyes to look at this thing from a different angle, and it really spawned in my mind something that I couldn't shake, that there's a side of the Christian faith that is meant to be done in secret, that no one sees, that is only between us and God. And so I've seen a lot of books on how to live out the Christian faith and how to share your faith. This one's more like the secret life that a Christian should have that nobody should ever see.
And so what you did was you lived your secret life, and then you wrote it in the book and then published it to send out to the world for all to see publicly. Good.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I am a hypocrite. Exactly. Thanks for pointing that out.
The book is to help people to understand that. Yeah. The title is
Art of the Christian Ninja.
Art of the Christian Ninja, Guide to Christian Devotion. Or it's got a subtitle, right? Has it worded?
Yeah, the subtitle is A Guide to Infiltration, Combat, and Assassination, the Jesus Way.
Yeah. Infiltration, Combat, and Assassination the Jesus Way. So just so that our hearers know this, this is not the ISIS handbook. This is speaking in the spiritual realm. And because spiritual warfare is a picture that's given in the Bible, El has adapted something that's cool. Ninjas! Ninja. I mean, who doesn't love ninjas? He's taken the idea of ninjas, and he's applied that spiritual warfare metaphor to our secret spiritual life, as it were, through the art of the Christian Ninja. So give us a few chapters.
Chapter titles: The Christian Ninja's Source of Power, The Art of Dependence, Hiding in Plain Sight, The Art of Infiltration, Traveling Light, The Art of Simplicity, Covert Operations, The Art of Ghostly Giving. It ends with The Christian Ninja at War. So the idea is I wanted this to be more than just another book, so I kept the chapters really short. I put meditation questions at the end of all the chapters, and best of all, I worked with a really great artist named Martin Mertonen, who drew the comics. He drew a bunch of comics for before the chapters and a bunch of really great decorations. So it's an artistic experience too. I do recommend you go to ihorus.com to see some of his work. Right now, I got another friend named Pierre Bellanger. He's putting it all together into this great looking format. So it's not only going to be for reading, but also like an experience. And if all goes well, it should be in print by June. So keep an eye out for it.
Your third chapter there, what's the title on it called again?
The third chapter is called Hiding in Plain Sight.
Yeah, Hiding in Plain Sight. Okay, I liked that chapter. I thought it was kind of fun. But he was talking about the ninja skill. You know, if anyone has seen the old anime Naruto, you may remember that Naruto is a young aspiring ninja who has blonde hair and blue eyes and lives in Japan, typically. And there's a little boy who is the grandson of the leader of their village, who idolizes and looks up to Naruto. And he follows him around the village. And there's these ninja hiding techniques, including holding up a blanket that has a picture of the background that you're hiding behind. But the little guy can't get anything right. So he's standing in front of a fence with vertical lines, and he holds the cloth up horizontally, so it's horizontal lines. And Naruto looks at him, and he says, what are you doing? Follow me. And the kid goes, wow, what amazing ninja skills you have to have seen through my skillful hiding. And I think there's an analogy where a lot of Christians are like that. So just give us a 2-minute snippet. What are you saying in that chapter?
Essentially that because ninjas are masters of disguise, and the idea is to go back and think about what ninjas did. They were masters of disguise. They know how to blend into society. They know how to act normal, but then all of a sudden at night they'd sneak over and they'd kill the leader of the clan. They knew how to sneak around that nobody knew. In fact, they needed to know another trade so that they could pretend to be your average worker and then go be a ninja at night. In the same way, we are God's secret agents on earth. So as a Christian, though we have interests and a purpose and a destiny in this world, we're also living out by God's decrees. We're living out with Jesus as our king, and we are his official messenger. So we're to be salt and light. And what does that look like in the world? How do we affect the world with salt and light without becoming like the world?
Kind of being in the world, but not of the world.
And exactly.
Loving the people in the world, but not loving the world and the lust thereof. So
let me give a quick read. At the last part, it says this. Just as a ninja would infiltrate an enemy palace and create disturbances meant to weaken the kingdom, so you are to infiltrate the world and do all you can to disrupt the plans of the enemy and do work for the king.
Yeah. So wonderful stuff. It's all in the spiritual realm again. This is not the handbook for the Christian version of ISIL. And
although if perverted, it could be.
So when you read it, don't pervert L sayings and turn them into some sort of a crazy guy. No, it's an interesting book, as usual. Of course, I don't agree with everything L says, but if I did, I would be mentally handicapped.
Oh, I think that meant hurt. I just got hurt. That hurt.
It's a good book. I recommend it. Have fun with it. Get into your divas because you need to be in the Word of God and you need to be in prayer, and that will be a helpful resource to you if you're looking for something like that. Thank you for listening to this edition of Carnivore Theology, where we answer questions relevant to people and so on and so forth. Goodbye. Oh, Facebook. SpeakPipe.
Yeah.
Website, carnivoretheology.com. Facebook.com/carnivoretheology.
Twitter.com/carnivoretheology.
Twitter.com/carnivoretheo. Carnivoretheo.
They wouldn't let me have all the letters.
/carnivoretheo. Or go to iTunes and search for Carnivore Theology and give us 5 stars.
Yeah.
No, that's particularly fascinating. Now, we have a SpeakPipe. Now, this is an interesting story because Steve usually manages this for us. But what we did was we covertly figured out his password by guessing the number of hairs on his head, and we were pretty much accurate. And so we broke into his email and we got our SpeakPipe.
I mean, it is only a four-letter password or four-number password.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was it was pretty easy.
You ready?
Hold on. You're digitizing on me. Is that happening? Can you hear that too?
No, I can't.
Hmm.
So, is it bad right now?
Yeah, you're like, is it bad right now?
Please get off the internet!
Love it. I love it. Jarvis, if you ever call again, what part of Saskatchewan are you from? I'm thinking, is it urine? Is it moose jaw?
Elbow?
Elbow? Is it peg leg? Like, you know, which significant body part? Steve would usually tell us that we're out of time, and he would help us wrap up. And, we don't know how to do that ourselves. Because we're pastors. Elle and I would just keep going. It's kind of, you know, if there's not a clock on the back wall, we just keep preaching.
Even if there is a clock on the back wall, I just keep preaching.
Well, that's fair enough, yeah. Usually by this time I drink so much coffee though that I have to get to the washroom. So, I'm getting out of here.
the subtitle is, hold on.
That's a book. It's interesting. Who knows who wrote it and what it's about. Anyway, Art of the Christian Ninja. And
No, I actually want to know. Hold on. I remember I wrote this down at one point.
Who wrote this thing? We need to find the author. Could we find the author of this book?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And, I had my copy called up, and I've now lost it, but your third chapter there, Al, what's the title on it called again?
I don't know.
Read your third chapter title.
I put it away. Hold on.
You have to edit this. This is lame now.
I know. I will. Third chapter. Doodly-doo.